for the SSDP network as it exists today. This person has managed to keep us together, keep the, not only the trains on time here at SSDP, but she keeps the cars hooked together. And she has been, without question, probably the person who has most defined the ways that you experience SSDP from the national level. And on top of all of that, she is the person who puts the most into making sure that this conference represents your voices, your views, your desires, and is a safe, sensible place for you to come learn, celebrate, and make new connections. Ladies and gentlemen, your conference mastermind, Stacia Nosner.
Entire 18-year history than we have this weekend. So thank you guys for being here. My name is Stacia Cosner, and I am not a morning person, but you guys are worth it. I'm really humbled to be up here, knowing that I was sitting right where you guys are 10 years ago at my first conference in 2006. I was a 19-year-old intern. I've served in every position the organization has to offer, from chapter member, chapter president, board member, intern, entry-level staff member, mid-level staff member. I was interim executive director for a scary 4 months before we got Betty. And today, I'm your deputy director. And I just want to take a second to thank the rest of our amazing staff who put in so much work to making this happen. So give them a hand. In fact, most of our staff started right where you guys were. Most of our staff are SSDP alums. And, you know, we're a grassroots organization, and we really mean that. We're nothing without you guys. So the work that you do, you know, informs the work that we do every day, and we're just so grateful to have you and your work. I first got involved with SSDP in 2005 as a freshman at the University of Maryland. Okay, well, that's fine. I'm kidding. And I got my dream job when I was hired at SSDP as an outreach coordinator when I graduated in 2009. Today, I'm deputy director, and I still love my work so much, as much as I did the very, very first day. I can't even tell you guys how fulfilling it is to be able to work for and with students who want to make a difference in this world by advocating for alternatives to the disastrous failed war on drugs. You people in this room are some of the most inspiring, enthusiastic, and intelligent people I've ever, ever had the pleasure of knowing.
Really?
Knowing that SSDPers are the future of drug policy reform, I've never been more confident that we can and will succeed in ending the harm caused by prohibition. You guys, the drug war has no idea how fucked it is. So, we've got a great program for you guys today. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce our first keynote speaker, Maya Salovitz. Maya is the author of Unbroken Brain, A Revolutionary Way of Understanding Addiction, which is published by St. Martin's Press just this month. She's a neuroscience journalist who's covered addiction and drug policy for nearly 30 years for publications ranging from Time and the New York Times to High Times and Vice. She's the author or co-author of 7 books, including Help at Any Cost, the first book to expose the tough love industry and the harm it does to youth and families. Please join me in welcoming Maya Salovitz.
Wow, thank you so much. I'm delighted and terrified and honored and really psyched to be here, actually. It's so great to see so many people so engaged in a cause that I have cared about for a really, really long time, ever since I first got involved with drugs as a teenager and became addicted to When I first started looking at what was wrong, I went to, I think, maybe the first or second ever Drug Policy Alliance meeting, and in that meeting there were way fewer people than there are here, maybe a few dozen. So it's amazing for me to see all of you guys, all your energy, you know, the fact that DPA now has thousands of people, you know, and the fact that we're actually seeing some real change starting. You know, for the last until maybe the last 5 or 6 years, drug policy was really this very stagnant thing where they had the same debates over and over and over again. We just thought it would, at least sometimes I thought it would never actually change. So to see the marijuana states, to see what's happening with the opioid, the ways we're trying to address the opioid issue, as racist as this has been, it is at least good to see us moving towards you know, health-based addiction treatment. And so I want to talk today about addiction as a learning disorder. And the reason I decided that this is probably the best way to frame it is because for a really long time we've tried to destigmatize addiction in the context of addiction being basically criminalized and 80% of the treatment being made up of the 12 steps, which involves surrender to a higher power, confession, restitution, and prayer. Now, if you went to the doctor for any other disease and you were told that the treatment was confession, meeting, and prayer, you would probably think that you went to a quack. And so, people very correctly, when they hear people making the argument that addiction's a disease and the treatment is either punishment or prayer, assume that you're lying about it being a disease, or assume that you have some kind of weird something going on where you are not, you know, your actions aren't matching your words. And so while I absolutely think addiction is a health and medical problem and not a choice, understanding what type of medical problem it is without all the baggage of the D word, I think can be very useful, especially to activists. And of course, I'm sure everyone in this room knows that the vast majority of people who use drugs do not become addicted. That only, even with drugs like heroin, only 15-20% become addicted. We obviously should care about the health of all drug users, but especially when harm is involved, that's what has been used to justify the war on drugs, the fact that there can be addiction and there can be overdose and there can be harm. So we need to understand better ways to deal with addiction, and I'm arguing that seeing it as a learning disorder is the way that will allow us to get past this, it's a disease, it's a sin, it's a crime debate that we continue to have and have had for about 100 years. So, why do we see addiction as a learning disorder? Well, basically, addiction can't happen without learning. You have to learn that the drug fixes something for you, either makes you feel euphoric, makes you feel comfortable, makes you feel safe. It does something for you, and you associate whatever that is with the drug. This is why babies can't actually be addicted, because while babies can suffer physical dependence on drugs like opioids and they will have withdrawal symptoms, a baby just feels discomfort and it doesn't know if it needs diaper change or mommy or milk or heroin. And it certainly cannot, a baby cannot go out and buy drugs and use them despite negative consequences, which is, you know, you can see the baby crawl onto the dealer, it's just not going to happen. It's not only stigmatizing, and in the era of crack did horrible harm to people who got the label crack baby, it is inaccurate. And it's based on this very old conception of addiction, which was the idea that addiction is physically needing a substance to function. And if that was addiction, well, we'd all be food, water, and air addicts. And I would be addicted to my Prozac, because if I stopped taking Prozac, I'd be depressed again. You know, I'm not out robbing drug drug like that, as probably people here who have taken antidepressants will know, you don't associate the drug with fixing you. It takes 2 weeks to work, for one. So, you know, but anyway, that sort of misconceived idea that addiction is physical dependence led to this really weird situation where cocaine was not considered addictive. And when I was in college at Columbia, cocaine was not considered addictive. And this was like right before crack. And you know, Scientific American said that the cocaine is as addictive as potato chips. Of course, this is funny now because now we're saying potato chips are as addictive as cocaine. At that time, that was seen as, oh, potato chips, no worries. But now, of course, we recognize that addiction has to be compulsive behavior despite negative consequences. It can't just be physically needing something. And so that definition, you have to learn the compulsive behavior and you have to persist despite the consequences. And this brings up something very interesting in regards to policy. Because if addiction is defined as compulsive behavior despite negative consequences, and negative consequences is basically a phrase that means punishment, how on earth is punishment going to stop addiction? Because if punishment stopped addiction wouldn't exist if it's compulsive behavior despite punishment. So this is one way that I think seeing the role of learning and seeing basically that addiction is a disorder of punishment learning tells us quite clearly what the solution isn't. And so what happens when you get addicted? It's basically a problem that involves the regions of the brain that are there for survival and reproduction. They're there to motivate you to do the stuff that's going to get your genes passed on. And so that's going to create really strong motivation. In addiction, you basically fall in love with a drug instead of a person or instead of your child. And that creates this, as any one of you who's ever been in love, it completely alters your priorities, your behaviors, what you think is important. If you are falling in love with a partner who is attached to someone else, you may begin lying and cheating. All the same kinds of behaviors that we see in addiction, we see in love. And we also see in parenting where, you know, most parents would do anything to make sure their kid is okay and to make sure they can take care of their kid. And obviously, we need a system that prioritizes behaviors that way because otherwise, nobody would ever survive a relationship. You must persist despite negative consequences to survive a relationship, and absolutely no one would ever survive a baby, given the diapers and all the other things that you have to put up with. You know, so we need to have this system. The problem is when it gets misdirected towards a drug. The good news about this way of seeing addiction is that love doesn't break your brain. Love is not a progressive disease. Love simply makes it so that, you know, when you hear that song or when you see that person that, you know, on Facebook that you didn't want to see, those feelings can come back. And this is the same thing where, you know, if a person with addiction sees like a needle or a spoon or something, they'll be like, you know. It's the same exact thing. The good news about this is, though, that like the vast majority of people survive breakups. It sucks, but we survive. And similarly, the vast majority of people with addiction actually outgrow addiction with or without treatment, and mostly without treatment. In fact, by age 30, 50% of all addictions, excluding tobacco, are over. And you probably never heard that statistic because it isn't one that the prohibitionists like to focus on much. But it is the case that most addictions do resolve with time. And if they don't, these severe cases are, of course, the ones that we see on the news and the ones that everybody focuses on, and the tragedies where we see, you know, people overdosing and all of these kinds of things. But the important thing there is that the hopelessness that has surrounded addiction has been based on a sort of what the scientists call a selection effect, where basically the people who show up in jail or in treatment are typically the worst cases. And the people that don't never seem so, people think they don't exist. The other important implication of the fact that a lot of people recover without help is that we should be talking to those people. We want to find out, how did you do that? So maybe some of the lessons may be transferable to the people who aren't so lucky as to, graduate without help. The other way in which addiction is similar to love is that when you fall in love with somebody or when you have a kid, your stress system gets wired to that person. So if you're without that person, or if you think the relationship is threatened, you're going to feel really stressed. And the same thing is true with addiction, which is why you have withdrawal and why you have all this really intense behavior done to preserve the relationship with the drug at all costs. And so, so once we understand this, we can see why addiction can look both like a choice and like a disease. It can look like a choice because nobody's shooting up in front of the police. Nobody's shooting up in court. I would always wait till I had cleaned my works and was very, because when I was using it was the 80s, and 50% of my fellow IV drug users in New York were already HIV positive. So I was pretty compulsive about using the needles, thankfully. But under the disease idea where you're totally powerless, I couldn't have waited to do that if I had been the zombie that the disease model sort of portrays people with addiction as. And the problem also with sort of seeing people with addiction as having no free will and being zombies is that people are terrified of zombies and they want to lock them up and get them out of their sight. If we understand that in addiction, people's choices are constrained in a way that everybody has probably experienced in relationship to either child-rearing or love, it becomes much more explicable, much less alien, and much less stigmatized, I think. So the other thing that we often hear about with regards to addiction that I think the idea of seeing it as a learning disorder sheds light on is that people have this idea that there's an addictive personality, and that people with addictions are like liars and cheaters and thieves and every negative thing you could possibly name. Unfortunately, that is deeply entangled with the racist history of the drug war. And these stereotypes around drug addiction are deeply tied to racist stereotypes. And so we've created this horrible mess where it's very, very hard to get past this because of the way those things are unfortunately connected. The reality is, though, that there isn't an addictive personality. Some people with addiction are like very bold and courageous and daring, and they want to try new things and they want to take risks that nobody else thinks are good idea to take. But then other people with addiction, more like me, are terrified of change and very anxious and nervous. And so it's possible to swing between both of those extremes, but most people with addiction don't have all of the traits that you would associate with the addictive personality. Some have none. So the one important thing to also keep in mind about that is that the traditional, when is an addict lying, when his lips are moving stereotype, this comes from the fact that, aside from the racist drug laws, it also comes from the fact that people who have antisocial personality disorder, which is marked by lying and manipulating and callous sort of behavior, they're 4 times more common among people with addiction than they are in the general population. Those people definitely give us a bad name. However, 82% of people with addiction do not have antisocial personality disorder, and it's important to recognize that and to realize, though, that while there can be some of this behavior, it is not inherent to addiction, and it has to do with things that come before that. The other thing that I think is really critical is 90% of all addictions start in the teens to mid-20s. And this is interesting because that's a sensitive period of brain development. There's three critical periods for brain development: prenatally, 0 to 5, and teens and young adults. And so it's really interesting that addiction concentrates at this time. I think what's going on, and a lot of scientists think that what's going on are two things. The first is that if your brain is still developing, introducing drugs to it might alter that in some way. And second, and I think the more important thing, is that during your teens and 20s, you tend to be learning the coping skills you're going to use to deal with relationships for the rest of your life. And if you don't learn them at that time, and you do learn that drugs work to solve these problems, it will be a lot harder to stop. And you will, when you stop, have to learn a lot of stuff that other people had learned while you were engaged in addiction. The interesting thing is, though, this means that if you manage to avoid addiction during these years, your odds of becoming addicted later in life are less than 1%. And this is interesting in light of the chronic pain situation, because a lot of people have been claiming that the opioid epidemic is driven by chronic pain patients. But in fact, 75% of people who take opioids illegally, the pain medications illegally, are using someone else's prescription. They're not pain patients. And this is not to say they're bad. It's just to say that we're talking about mostly separated populations, and cracking down on the poor people in pain is not going to help them when most of the addicted people are not getting drugs directly from doctors. And we've seen what happens when you simply shut down a bunch of pill mills, terrorize doctors so they cut prescribing. Now we have people moving to heroin, we have street fentanyl. It's like the business of that iron law of prohibition, where when you ban something, you end up getting stronger and smaller versions of it simply because that's easier to smoke. This is another example where learning is very, very important. So how can this help your activism? When people understand that addiction is misguided learning, it seems to make sense more than the disease idea and more than the sin idea, because it allows you to go through the real behavior of the way people with addiction act. And at the same time, it's not blaming people with addiction for having it, and it's recognizing that, so why is it that 15 to 20% of people with addiction, 50% of drug users do get addicted? What's different about this group? And from what we can tell, two major factors in what's different are the mental illness, which affects about 50% of people with addiction, and childhood trauma, which affects about 2/3 of people with addiction. So right there, you have two big things. The other important factor in addiction is, it's been called dislocation. You can call it alienation, isolation, lack of meaning and purpose. I think a lot of what we're seeing with the opioid situation now reflects this, where you have the middle class, the white middle class, collapsing basically, and facing the same kind of conditions that black communities faced during crack. And it, not surprisingly, you're seeing higher rates of problems. So understanding this also tells us that focusing simply on supply is not going to work. It's kind of like assuming that if we ban hemp so you can stop stop obsessive OCD hand washing. It just doesn't work like that. I think all of this stuff can come together in a way that would be useful for thinking about addiction, thinking about what it is, thinking about how it affects people, and also supporting harm reduction. One of the amazing things about harm reduction is that, in the traditional view of addiction, you had to hit bottom. And since we know that punishment doesn't fix addiction, hitting bottom is a really dumb idea. It really does not, if you're trying to stop a condition by just punishing and punishing and punishing, you're going to end up killing some people, and you're not going to end up helping a lot of people. Because what people with addiction really need in order to recover is hope and love. And in fact, in opioid addiction, the reality is that the only things proven to cut the death rate by 50% or more is long-term, lifelong, potentially, maintenance with methadone and suboxone. Now, thankfully, both of those are off patent, so we will not be aiding Big Pharma by pushing for more maintenance treatment. Vivitrol, on the other hand, is on patent, and there's no evidence that it saves lives. So it's important to know that with opioids in particular, the pharmaceutical question is complex. I think it's really important that people get social support, that people realize that just saying something is a brain disease is denying, shouldn't be denying the fact that social stuff matters critically. But there are some people, and I happen to be one of them, for whom without a certain medication, I don't function. Like, my life sucks because I'm just overwhelmed by sensory issues that I think are related to some sort of so the, you know, I think it is important to fight the commercialization, to fight the advertising, to fight the lying. But at the same time, not to switch from one set of bad drugs to another set of bad drugs. Any drug, well, almost all drugs, can be good in one situation and terrible in another. Somebody might take the same drug that I'm taking and be homicidal or suicidal. Whereas for me, it makes life livable. I think we need to respect that some people are going to need medications, and everybody should have an absolute choice about their medication. And we should not be forcing this on people. But we should be giving people the information that, for example, you go to a rehab for 28 days, nobody tells you they're not giving you the one treatment that can cut the death rate by 50%. I think that's not practical. You don't necessarily have to choose that treatment, but you should know it.
They really can provide insight, they really might like help some people.